Welcome. First, I want to thank all of you for deciding to come to this event. I'm very honored that this many people thought that this talk would be cooler than Zork. I can tell you right now that you've made a grave... You know what? I'm going to leave it up to you guys. I'm going to leave it up to you. You know, usually people up here, you know, remind you to that, you know, an email is coming with a review of this talk, and that, you know, give me fives. I need fives so I can come back here next year. I want you guys to vote with your hearts. I want you to just be honest. You know, I feel like maybe the talk deserves maybe a three. I'd be happy to walk home with a two, though. So I don't want you to feel pressured to give me a five. Also, turn off the things. There was a third thing. Oh, also, I've timed this talk to be exactly 25 minutes long. I tried to cut it down, but there's just so much design-spiration in this presentation, I couldn't possibly cut out any more. So unfortunately, there probably won't be time for questions, but I will. There is a makeup room. The room down there. I'll be in the room if you want to talk after the talk. Okay, so my name is Matthew Derby. For the none of you that know who I am, I work as an interface designer at Harmonix. I've worked on features for Rock Band 2, Rock Band 3, and the Rock Band Network, as well as Disney Fantasia : Music Evolved, a motion-based music game based on the legendary film. I also helped design the interface of the engine we use to develop Fantasia, and I'm currently working on our latest project, a musical shooter called Chroma. And so, you know, I'm here obviously to talk about using comics as design documentation. Now, I want to say first off that I'm not a huge comics guy. So if you want to have a conversation about Crisis on Infinite Earths or, you know, why they haven't made a Marvel Civil War movie yet, I'm just going to disappoint you. Because I'm not here to talk about my favorite comics. I want to talk instead about how sequential art is a powerful tool that I've used to facilitate design discussions with members of my teams, illustrate the interdependencies among features, and most importantly, keep the focus of my design on the player. Because comics are fundamentally about people. Even from a great distance, it's clear that comics are about people's lives. We see a sequence of framed human figures and we're compelled to explore them. We're instantly curious, like, you know, what makes this person tick? What is making them sad or tired or exhilarated? Comics bring us face to face with people we might not otherwise know and invite us to feel something about them. They invite us to empathize. So now think about the game you're making. Think about the people who you hope will one day play this game. How often do you put their needs before your own desires? When you frame your design in the form of a comic with a representative player as your main character, you're putting that player's needs in the spotlight. And when your player is no longer a set of eyeballs or a living ATM machine, but a real person, you're able to start making decisions on their behalf. You're on your way to making a game that your fans will truly love. So here's what I'm going to go over today. First, I'm going to talk about how I came to use the comic form to help me solve a gnarly design issue. And then I'm going to show you how you can make your own comic, even if you're not an artist, in fact, especially if you're not an artist, by leading you through another example where I had to quickly collaborate on a time-sensitive in-game UI feature. And then I'll talk about when you can get the most use out of these design comics. So there were two comic reading experiences that got me thinking about how I might use the form to help communicate my design ideas. And the first was this crude three-frame comic that someone sent me in an email on October 9th, 2001. Now, I don't remember who sent it. I certainly didn't know who'd made it. You know, I just remember being taken completely off guard by it. My first response was, sweet Christ, this is hideous. It was just a couple pieces of clip art and slapped together with some terrible speech balloons and Helvetica text. And it was red and white instead of black and white, which kind of made this pulsing behind my eyeballs. But despite its aesthetic shortcomings, this weird little comic managed to do something astonishing. It broke through the gloom that hung over the days following September 11th. It was hilarious and defiant and angry, and it gave a shape to my fear and anxiety. Now, I didn't know who'd made this comic, but I knew that somewhere out there across the vast ocean of the internet, there was someone else who was as scared and indignant as I was about Operation Enduring Freedom. And that person had, with just a few bits of clip art, made a deep, enduring, and immediate human connection with me. And then 7 years later, another comic in a much different context lodged itself in my brain. Google hired Scott McCloud to create a comic extolling the virtues of its new Chrome browser. Now, Google knew that the tech specs that made Chrome a better browser would be lost on the majority of people who use the web every day, but who aren't necessarily motivated to read a wall of text to find out how their information is more secure using Chrome. But in comic form, with Google employees stepping readers through the Chrome feature set, using tangible metaphors delivered in an informative and entertaining way, the advantages became crystal clear. They knew that the power of visual storytelling, a narrative form that puts people first, would capture their users' attention in a way that nothing else could. It was such an effective format for communicating complex information that I started thinking about how I could use it in my own designs. So at around this time, I was hired by Harmonix as a user experience designer for their web team. This was at the very height of the rock band craze. Record labels were lining up outside our doors to get their artists into the game. And there was no way we could possibly accommodate everyone. Because authoring a song was costly, and we could only do so much in-house. So often we found that we were accepting songs from the highest bidders, and we left independent artists and labels at the back of the line. And so this made us really uncomfortable. So we decided to create a system by which artists and labels could collaborate with independent track authors to make playable tracks available via as DLC in the Xbox Live marketplace. So this was an idea that we were really excited about as a company because it reflected the Harmonix spirit of community building and held the promise of a broader range of content, which was core to the vision of our game. But there was just one problem. Authoring a track, at least in the way that we felt a track should be authored, one that was fun, authentic, and playable at all levels of difficulty on all authored instruments, was fucking hard. It wasn't the kind of thing that any kid on the street could pick up in an afternoon. It would take patience and dedication and the involvement of many people. Because in addition to an author, we had to have a community of volunteer playtesters who could ensure that the songs met our standards. Then we had to get the song through Microsoft's stringent contravention pipeline. One thing that Microsoft is really worried about was, and I learned the term TTP at this meeting, which is time to penis, and that is the length of time when you offer UGC to players and they come back with a penis. And we were like, well, how could you make a penis out of Rock Band? Oh, okay. Yes, that way. So, and I still want to know, like, I'm still interested. Like, what does a penis sound like? Like, how would you play that? What would it sound like? Anyway, sorry. The talk is now 26 minutes. I'm going to have to be cut off. So then we had to figure out how to pay the author, artist, and label at the end of the process. So as you can see, the system had a lot of players and a lot of moving parts. We knew that we wanted to create as cohesive an experience as possible, given the number of constraints we were under, but it was almost impossible to see how all these parts were going to work together. So I stared for a long time at a diagram that looked something like this, only instead of periwinkle, it was the color of my tears. You know, I didn't know where to begin. You know, but then I thought about that Chrome comic. I thought about how Scott McCloud had cleverly used Google employees to tell the story of the product. But, you know, those Google employees had actually built the Chrome browser, and, you know, we had not done any work on this endeavor yet. You know, so I needed someone who could talk to me, as weird as that sounds. I needed someone to help me work through the design, and someone with whom I could empathize, like those angry office workers in Get Your War On, the comic that we saw earlier. So with these references in the back of my head, I decided to invent a character, a representative of the type of person who'd most likely author a rock band track. I thought, if I could just figure out what this system needed to do for this one person, the rest would be that much easier. But I'm not an artist, and I certainly didn't have the time or resources to hire Scott McCloud to make my comic for me. So, like David Reese, the creator of Get Your War On, I stole. Adrian Tomine, who's one of my favorite comics artists, had just published the book Shortcomings, which was about a guy with a bunch of hang-ups who ruins a perfectly good relationship and ends up alone and depressed. In other words, my kind of story. And so I really like Tomine's art style, which is very clean and realistic. The main character, who's sort of a grump, has a lot of really amazing expressions throughout the book. This is one of my favorites. Whenever I think about my own head, like if I were looking at my own head, I imagine myself making this exact expression all the time. So I really like this face. I like this character. He just looked like the kind of person that would sink hours into creating a rock band track. So I scanned a bunch of pages from the book and cut his head out using Photoshop. There were only a few frames of Tomine's character that I thought would work well, which was fine with me because, you know, at this point, I didn't even know if this was going to work. I told myself I'd spend about a half an hour cutting these out and just see what happens. And that felt like the right investment of time. Now, I called him Bill Smith, because I didn't want to draw too much attention to him as a character. I wanted him to be transparent enough so that the eventual readers of my comic could imagine themselves in Bill's shoes. In his amazing book, Understanding Comics, Scott McCloud talks about the need to find a balance between specificity and universality to allow your readers to empathize with your character. If you add too little detail, your readers may have trouble placing themselves in the character's shoes. And too much detail and specificity, and there's no room for your readers to actually inhabit the character. This is a key to making a successful design comic. You want your readers to see the story through someone else's eyes, but you also want to invite them to become that character as well. So I made a rectangular frame and put Bill Smith in front of a sketch of the Rock Band Network website, which was going to be the hub for all of the author playtester interactions. And I swear that coffee stain was not intentional, I'd think. I mean, in 2008, if I put my coffee down there intentionally with the thought that I was going to eventually present at GDC, that seems crazy. There's no way that could have happened. But as soon as I did that, as soon as I started designing through Bill Smith's eyes, things got much clearer. Not easier, but clearer. Just by framing the front page of this website within a comic-style border, and by having this picture of Bill Smith looking at the website, I was suddenly building something for someone else. I was making all of my decisions based on Bill's expectations. So all I had to do was go through every step of the process with Bill. I was suddenly able to anticipate his thoughts and desires and build the experience around him. So my team and I walked Bill through the steps necessary to set up his account so that he could submit his authored track to the community. We had a basic understanding of the pipeline's architecture, but we hadn't built anything yet. So this exercise of shaping Bill's story was also our process of discovering how to build and implement the tool. Because we were following Bill's story and not a bullet list of features, we could see the relationships between the widgets and components we'd previously been talking about in isolation. It was much easier to make calls about what was important because we were always looking at what was most important to Bill. His presence in the document allowed us to really see how things would work together in real time. So in the end, we had a 40-page document that clearly showed how an author would create and submit a track, respond to playtest feedback, and publish to the Xbox Live Marketplace. We realized we'd essentially created a ready-made guide that we could distribute to beta testers. So I whipped up a cover, and we sent the comic to them, both as a way to solicit early feedback, but also as a sort of training guide. And since its launch, the Rock Band Network has yielded over 17 billion songs. No, like 3,000 songs, which maybe that doesn't sound impressive, but that was more than the amount that we were able to produce in-house over the course of the 5 years that we cranked out weekly DLC. So it allowed fans of our game to come together and express themselves through music in a whole new way. And while it would be unrealistic to say that we couldn't have launched the project without Bill, his involvement helped us make better decisions faster without expending valuable dev time. So once I had this framework, I decided to try it out in as many contexts as possible. I learned a lot about when design comics are most useful, which I'll share with you later on. But the one thing these crude little comics all had in common was that they got people talking. Sometimes people liked what they saw, and sometimes they didn't. But always, these design comics were instrumental in facilitating discussion. This particular presentation of information ensures that everyone in the room is talking about the same thing. It's always easier to make your way toward a solution if everyone has all the same information, when everyone is reacting to the same story. So then I went to work on Fantasia, which, for those of you who don't know, is a music game for Kinect that involves gesture-based beat-match gameplay paired with exploratory musical interactions. I was put in charge of the meta team, which handled everything outside the core gameplay experience. And one of our challenges was to establish a system for the messaging of player goals. Now, we knew that Fantasia had to be a family-friendly game, so Bill Smith and his acerbic hipsterism just was not going to fit. So instead, we developed a character that we called Allison. We decided that Allison was an 11-year-old girl who was a Disney fan and a gamer. Now, we could have drawn up a character that exhibited the worst stereotypes of an adolescent American girl in the 21st century. Like a gum-snapping, princess-worshipping little troll who speaks in questions but who's never actually asking questions. But not only would this be gross and dishonest and not reflective of the real girls we knew in our lives, it would also prevent the members of our team from investing in the idea of our representative player. In order to create a sense of empathy, we needed to create a persona that was authentic and specific. So I just finished reading Alison Bechdel's incredible comic, Fun Home, and I thought that her drawings of herself as a kid would work perfectly for Allison. Now, the central gameplay mode in Fantasia has players gesturing to on-screen cues, sort of like Mickey Mouse on the clifftop sequence in the original film. I'm just going to show you a video to help illustrate this because it's hard to describe. And there's audio there. It's a, yes. So you'll see that at dramatic moments in the song, players have the opportunity to unlock, to switch between three distinct mixes of the song. And these mixes are unlocked when players hit certain thresholds, score thresholds, or other type of goals that they will have, that they'll be presented to them at the beginning of the song. So this presents a problem because the unlocks are always fixed at fixed sections in the song, but the player can unlock these before they get to the reward. So the goal and the reward are separated in time. So we had to come up with a way to message this to players. Now, to add to this problem, there was a lot of debate across the project at this point about how much UI we should even show in this mode. A certain camp certain number of people on the team thought that we shouldn't show any UI in this mode, that this was supposed to be a beautiful, synesthetic experience that a score would only distract from. And then there were the people on the other side that said, no, the score is important always. We need to show this. And so both sides were using Allison as a way to justify their cause. So this seemed like the perfect scenario for a design comic. But in order to solve this problem, we had to manipulate time. So one problem with traditional design documentation is that it's fixed in the eternal present. It's incredibly difficult to convey how an interface changes over time, especially if that interval spans days or weeks. You can describe these changes in text, but comics allow us to literally transport players through time using this common language that is nearly universal. You can jump through an entire month in two frames or slow down time and render a microsecond over the course of a dozen frames. We can get away with this fluid time travel because of a concept known as closure. When we see two images next to one another and they seem to have something in common, our brains immediately try to close the gap between them. It doesn't even take any effort for us to create this sense of closure. It's hardwired into our system. Comics take advantage of this phenomenon all the time, and we can too. So back to the goal messaging situation. I booked a one-hour meeting with the Beatmatch design lead, Jim Topol, and we vowed that we'd come out of the session with a clear plan we could bring to both of our teams. So we started by filling out a whiteboard with a series of frames. Then we went through and filled them in as though they were frames in a comic. When we had to illustrate a messaging moment, we'd devote two or three frames to show the entrance and exit behavior of the message. But then we could just speed through the remainder of the song section in a single frame. So this scrubbing of the song's timeline allowed us to hit the problem areas hard without losing the larger context of the song. So as you can see, these are some pretty rough sketches. They probably actually don't mean a whole lot to you, but they were of a high enough resolution that Jim and I could see all of the problem areas in the song at a single glance, and we were able to focus in on the most important moments when goals were accomplished and rewards were distributed. So after our meeting, I went back to my desk and added Allison, a speech balloon, and some explanatory text, and I had the rudiments of a comic that we could present to the team for immediate reaction and feedback. And when they saw the proposal in this format, with the song laid out start to finish, with all the key moments illustrated, even the most skeptical team members saw that we were really only talking about a sliver of gameplay real estate, not only in space, but in time. And they realized that the song would actually be more fun to play with the proper goal messaging and rewards in place. So once we got initial buy-in from the teams, I made a higher resolution version of the comic with more polished assets that Jim and I could use for subsequent specs. And these comics were used across the project in discussions among designers, leads, and QA. And Bill Smith even came back for a cameo as Allison's older brother when we needed to design the multiplayer UI. He'd moved back in after he failed to fund his Kickstarter for a pocket pet salon, and so he just had a lot of time on his hands to play Fantasia with his sister. So I'm getting the time is up. And there's just so much more design inspiration in my talk that I want to share with you, but I can't. But if you want to go to the makeout room after, please do. And maybe I can give the other 17 minutes of my presentation. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming here. Again, it's a tremendous sacrifice on your part, and I appreciate that. Thank you. Vote with your heart.